Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I've got 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts delivering all the essential updates you need fast and focused. It's Monday, the 30th of September. On our program today, can a VAT exemption on chickens help stimulate the South African economy? Jobs shed in the mining industry. Does the sector have a recovery plan? Why an expert says ESG naysayers are wrong, and an African transport invention testing the limits of solar power. Now, this probably doesn't come as a surprise to you, but South Africa's mining industry does remain on the back foot, losing as many as 7,000 jobs in the second quarter of this year. So how bad are things right now, and is there a recovery trajectory? Someone at the center of this debate is Minerals Council South Africa Chief Economist, Hego Pienaar, who joins me on the program. Hego, welcome to you. Maybe just elaborate on the key factors then driving these significant job losses in the sector, and I think particularly in the PGM sector.
Yes, good afternoon, Jeremy, and to the listeners. Yes, 100%. It is indeed in the PGM or the platinum group metals sector where we are seeing most of the retrenchments. Now, I think it's important to mention that Statistics South Africa, who releases the official job numbers, they don't split the mining sector into the different subcomponents. So they just give us the overall number for mining, which is then around the 7,000 job losses that you mentioned in the second quarter. But we, of course, know from company announcements the last 6 months or so that certainly the platinum industry or sector is the subcategory of domestic mining that is under most pressure. And that, to a very large extent, has to do with a low-price environment. So platinum, palladium, rhodium, the three key metals in PGMs, those prices have all been under significant pressure the last 18 months or so. And that is weighing heavily on profitability in that sector.
And I suppose, Hego, you've got to add to that rising input costs, particularly electricity and logistics, and that just compounds the problem.
So thankfully, Jeremy, on the PGM side, logistics is not really an issue because we basically fly out those exports. But certainly, if we think in the broader mining sector, the so-called bulk minerals, coal, iron ore, chrome and manganese, those sub-components have been heavily impacted by Transnet's logistic issues. And certainly, we are not just but the broader business community is working with government and Transnet to try and resolve those issues. On the power situation, you're 100% correct. We have, of course, received a very nice boost from the absence of load shedding or load curtailment in the mining sector since the end of March. But you are right. The electricity price increases, so now we don't have to worry that much about the availability of power anymore. But certainly, the affordability of power remains a big concern. And just on that, Jeremy, we have heard, of course, from Eskom that they are requesting more than a 36% increase in electricity tariffs from next year, April, from NERSA, the energy regulator. And we would certainly be pushing back strongly against that quantum of increase, and not just from a mining sector perspective, but just from the economy in general, even households. We think that is just an untenable increase at this stage. At any stage.
You use the word untenable. Should there be an increase of anywhere between 30 and 40%, as is being suggested, what direct impact might that have on the mining industry, and again, particularly for job prospects?
So, Jeremy, it's interesting. We've every now and then the theme of beneficiation comes back. Certainly from government's point of view, since the formation of the GNU, if one talks about mining, there's been a lot of focus on beneficiation. Now, this is, of course, where you take the raw ores that the mines take out of the ground and you add value to them. But often this is through a smelting or a refining process, and that is very energy intensive. So it would certainly be those type of smelting operations, the beneficiation part of mining would come under particular pressure if we do see these types of increases.
Jucha, I'm trying to find some green shoots here, as economists like to talk about. Given that the PGM sector is a major employer in mining, but we are looking at macroeconomic improvements, lower inflation, as we've discussed, the absence of load shedding, are you in any way in the short to medium term seeing some kind of turn?
Yeah, so I think indeed, Jeremy, so if we just think of the cost of capital in South Africa, long-term interest rates, so along with inflation that has come down, a bit more optimism about South Africa's political outlook, those long-term interest rates have come down substantially the last 3 months or so. So definitely from a mining sector perspective, that is a positive. Perhaps just, you know, we speak about the PGMs and all of the difficulties there. The one lifeboat currently is what we're seeing in chrome. So chrome is often a byproduct of PGM mining, and the chrome price has been doing quite well. Strong demand from China. South Africa is one of the biggest producers of chrome in the world. And in fact, last year we had record exports, all-time high exports of chrome from South Africa. If we look at the numbers so far this year, we're going to surpass that record this year. So that chrome portion of the PGM mining sector to their revenue is increasing, and that is a support. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are parts of the South African mining sector that have grown quite strongly in recent years and continue to do so. Perhaps just very briefly, Jeremy, on copper is also a very interesting development. So our copper production has been in decline for many years, but with the sort of green transition minerals, the focus on copper, the high copper price, we are seeing an interesting reemergence of copper mining in the Northern Cape province. And if one looks at what some of the companies are saying, within the next 3 to 5 years, we have the potential to double our output or our production of copper. So it's certainly not all doom and gloom in the domestic mining sector.
And that's where I am going to leave it. Jucha Pienaar, thank you very much indeed. He is Chief Economist at the Minerals Council of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's turn now from platinum to poultry, and the South African Poultry Association and the Fair Play Movement have once again proposed exempting specific chicken products from value-added tax to provide significant relief for low-income households and also to boost the poultry industry, which turns over something like 65 billion rand a year and employs close to 150,000 people. Francois Baird is from Fair Play and joins me on the program now. Francois, first of all then, how would this exemption impact low-income households? To what extent have you crunched the numbers here?
Well, we have started crunching the numbers, and of course, Fair Play already put in a request to the government in 2018, where the Woolard Commission couldn't arrive at an answer, and so it wasn't done. But since then, support has been growing. And it would cost the fiscus, back then we said approximately 6 billion rand. This time around, it seems we need to be a little more modest in what we ask for. Certain chicken pieces, like feet, offal, and bone-in pieces that low-income households can afford. So we're not asking for all chicken to be VAT-free. We're asking for a very limited number. And we believe that the levies from anti-dumping duties would be able to cover, if not all, at least a large portion of those costs, and therefore make it a neutral situation for government. There was a pause of a year in the anti-dumping levies, and we saw that it made no difference to the cost to consumers. And that's because anti-dumping duties really hurt the producers and jobs in the industry. It doesn't concern the consumer. And therefore, we think that proper review targeting specific pieces of the chicken, that is the preferred meat of people on low incomes, will help the health of the nation without hurting the fiscus.
Why do you think there has been a reluctance in the past?
The reluctance in the past was mostly, I believe, from what we have been able to gather at Fairplay, a difficulty in figuring out how to pass on the benefit of having VAT-free chicken in an affordable way. And there was also, I believe, a certain measure of distrust between certain politicians, government, and the industry. My hope is that this distrust will be bridged, because the industry, as far as we can tell from our conversations with them, the industry is very, very committed to passing on the benefits of VAT-free chicken to consumers, and therefore the added benefit of growth in the industry. Some people think it may even add up to 10% growth in the industry itself, the poultry industry, as well as more jobs, will overcome the reluctance. And we think once we go down this path, there is so much support for it that consumers, small children will benefit. You know, Jeremy, we have in South Africa an exceptionally high stunting rate for children under 5. And this is what they need. They need access to animal protein.
Obviously, you're making overtures to all the critical stakeholders, Francois. At this point, maybe compared to your previous efforts, what sort of indication are you getting on more rapid movement?
We believe that the obstacles could be overcome given the general goodwill towards this effort. It's a national effort, and it's in the interest of those people most deserving of having access to low-cost chicken. It will also grow jobs, and therefore it's in favor of helping to support our effort in this country to create jobs. In addition, there is so much that could be done once this effort has delivered a result. For instance, exports and other ways in which to grow the industry and further lower the cost of producing chicken in South Africa, which is already one of the most competitive industries in the world. So this is a no-brainer, really, for doing the right thing. Mm.
Francois, it all comes down to trade-off and compensation. And there is an argument that says reducing VAT on a widely consumed product like chicken could in fact impact or widen the budget deficit if there isn't that compensation for the loss through other means. That puts pressure on public finances, which I don't need to tell you we can ill afford at the moment.
We agree with the importance of making it affordable, not only for the consumers, but making it affordable for the fiscus. And we believe that the levying of anti-dumping duties to the 9 countries, producers in the 9 countries that have been found guilty of dumping, can help to pay for that. And in addition, by narrowing the definition of the chicken pieces that are VAT-free, it would further restrain the burden on the fiscus. And so we believe with goodwill and some pragmatic, practical ways in which to tackle the problem, this is possible. We are more hopeful than ever, especially since the President announced this review obviously expecting that there will be a possibility of getting it done. And we hope that the government will get it done.
The other argument, of course, Francois, is that implementing VAT cuts selectively for certain products can add a degree of administrative complexity, and that could increase compliance costs.
Of course, the basket is already there. There are different items in the VAT-free basket. What is not in the VAT-free basket is an animal protein. And that is why the most loved animal protein, particularly of lower income households, is chicken and should be in the VAT-free basket. Not across the full spectrum of poultry products, but particularly those pieces that's most consumed in low-income households.
And let me ask you one final question. There's always, of course, no guarantee that retailers will pass on the full VAT cut to consumers. Some may choose to increase their margins instead of lowering prices.
That is, of course, a possibility. But I think there is so much effort now between all South Africans to make our country successful and to look after people who have less than most other people in the country, that retailers would be well advised to pass on the benefits to consumers. And I believe that there are ways of tracking this, of course, traceability and other ways in which to track whether they are indeed passing on the benefit, and that it would be possible to hold their toes to the fire if they don't.
Francois Baird, thank you very much indeed. Always a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, I want to jump into a topic now that has been causing a fair amount of debate in the financial sector, ESG, or environmental, social and governance investing. While some critics question its relevance, my guest today believes otherwise. So joining me now is Conway Williams, head of credit at Prescient Investment Management. Conway, there has, as you know, been a lot of debate around the effectiveness of ESG in financial performance. What are your thoughts around this skepticism?
So I think the first thing is how you use ESG is of utmost importance. So throughout our investment approach, since we started considering how to discharge our fiduciary duties, we've understood that you have to consider both financial and non-financial risks. And ESG fits into that bracket of those softer qualitative type issues that you need to consider. So if you're just thinking of using it as a risk management tool, we found it completely useful. It has shown us risks that we didn't even believe was possible when you're simply considering the financials and assessing a viability of an option from a quantitative perspective. Because you unearth issues such as governance risks, legislative, regulatory changes, whether the composition of the board is appropriate, how you treat your staff. All of those are very, very important factors. And I think the backlash is coming in that ESG has been used and there's been massive issues on greenwashing, used under the guise that it is there to save the world. We as investment professionals have to actually discharge our duties and make sure that we put risk management at the heart of what we do. And if you don't combine both the qualitative and the quantitative factors, you are missing a leg of a holistic investment approach.
All right.
And that is why we are very firm on it is here to stay and it will always be used.
All right. Point is taken. You mentioned the word greenwashing. Critical then that you've got to differentiate between authentic ESG and people paying lip service. How do you go about making that differentiation?
So I think there's we see impact and developmental or green investing very different to the assessment of risk. So for example, we've got green, clean funds and untraditional funds. When we consider ESG financial, non-financial risks, we use that across both funds. Where there's a little bit of a difference in that the assets that we would put into our green fund would just be different to what we'd put into our traditional funds. For example, assets under the REIPPPP structure, they would go into our developmental infrastructure green funds. And those have societal impacts and the likes. But irrespective of which type of asset it is, we have to have an ESG view on that counterparty, on that investment company, or on that opportunity. So risk management is, again, different to impact and what you want to achieve from a developmental outcomes perspective. And once you can differentiate the two, you can understand that you're actually using it in the right manner to unearth risks, and then secondly, just to make sure that the forecasts that you are putting into your models are actually providing resilient type opportunities that can withstand various cycles and the likes. So that is why the impact slash developmental versus risk perspective needs to be factored into how you approach ESG. And ultimately, ESG is just non-financials or qualitative risks that you are unearthing.
All right, I am going to play devil's advocate here because let me state up front, I'm also quite fond of the planet and I understand that these things are important. But often incorporating ESG into an investment strategy could be seen as limiting. So how do you view its role in enhancing long-term value and performance?
Yeah, and that's a very important question, right? So if I'm just looking at what we're doing, we are providing companies with debt funding. In that instance, we just need to understand if they have the ability to pay us back. Or alternatively, we're investing in companies to see what sort of returns we can make. If you embed these ESG factors into it, it either increases your discount rate, it impacts the cash flows that you model and the likes, or it impacts whether you believe there's an increased default probability risk within an investment. And that if you're looking at it from that perspective, you can understand why these risks that you are considering allows you to do various sensitivities to see, one, whether you'd get paid back, or two, whether the returns available are sufficient for that risk. So we're actually toggling risk as opposed to fixing the world, making the world a better place when we do ESG risk assessment.
So you would be doing your risk assessment yourself in terms of investment decision, but you also mentioned Regulation 28, which mandates the integration, as you said, of ESG factors for fiduciary investors. How good or how significant is the regulation at this point, or are there gaps?
So I think there are gaps. We fully understand it. But what Regulation 28 makes very clear is that for you to discharge your fiduciary duty, you have to consider qualitative, non-financial, and financial risks in your assessment of an opportunity. There's no gray area when it comes to that. How you do it, where you get the data from, all of these pose significant questions on how ESG is actually used, the consistency thereof, and the likes. And that does raise a lot of questions on the merits of ESG or not. So what we have done internally is we've built our own ESG rating mechanism. It considers 67 factors across E, S, and G. And then we embed that into our process. We vet the data, we do the analysis, and we check the outcome. But again, the question on consistency of approach and the likes does raise questions across the industry. So if there is, for example, improved guidance on how it should be rolled out, data sources and the likes, I think we could push ESG much faster. And we can actually continue to prove the merits of ESG.
So in terms of your own due diligence, I mean, 67 points is fairly considerable. When you're running through those criteria, are there typically areas within ESG where companies fail?
So what we do see in integrated annual reports are massive focuses on societal issues, which are great. There's also factors on governance and on the actual environmental side. But the problem is that it's not always consistently applied. So remember, data in needs to be analyzed, and then you get your output that you can consider. So if the data is inconsistent coming in, or the actual data isn't good enough, which we have seen in various reports, then it does become a problem. So then you're actually giving a company an NA, and you're underscoring them when they could actually have a policy. But it's just that it hasn't been a focus. Or for this year, they did amazing work on the S side, and then your report focuses mostly on staff and societal issues that you have addressed. So I think it's more just the consistency of reporting. We have seen new regulation come in. SAICA recently hosted quite a decent event where there was a launch on ISSB. And that could actually be a big push in the right direction because it's under accounting in terms of what needs to be reported, and potentially bringing consistency into how investee companies report and then how we can assess information.
So Conway, you're a data guy. It's all about the numbers. You mentioned at the start of this conversation that ESG integration does lead to better financial outcomes. Are you able to quantify that as a general percentage?
It is very hard to do that. We do know which factors have actually led us to show that there's improved default probabilities. Interesting enough, in the South African market, we've seen, so we rate companies, and then we also consider ESG, that the societal factor in the South African context actually has the largest bearing on default probability risk. How you treat your staff, how you treat your immediate communities around you, and if you can just understand the South African context, you can understand why that has such a large drive on whether a company is going to have sustainable cash flows or not. It came to a surprise to us. We thought it would be governance, because most of the failings, whether it was Lonmin, Steinhoff, African Bank, were governance issues. But we actually found that the societal impact has the biggest bearing on company risk in our market.
Conway Williams, I'm going to leave it there. That is a very interesting conversation. Head of Credit at Prescient Investment Management. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program, an electric motorcycle designed and built here in Africa and powered by the sun is tackling the long drive all the way to Nairobi. Researchers from the Faculty of Engineering at Stellenbosch University have joined forces with a company called Roam. It's a technology-driven electric mobility organization in Nairobi to test the Roam Air. It's a tailored electrical motorcycle designed in Kenya for Africa. In conversation now with Professor Tinus Boysen, who is founder of the Electric Mobility Lab at Stellenbosch University. And Professor, let's maybe start with a project overview.
It's a bit of a long story, but we started doing electric mobility research about 5 years ago. And in doing the research, we realized increasingly that electric mobility in Africa is different to electric mobility that you'll find in developed countries. And the biggest differences are our what we call paratransit system, our informal transport system, which constitutes basically or comprises minibus taxis. And in the other thing in sub-Saharan Africa that's different is two-wheeler bikes that are used as taxis, and also obviously non-motorized transport. But very quickly we realized that in the developed countries there's not a lot of research going on two-wheeler electrification. So you may not know, but in sub-Saharan Africa there are already tens of thousands of electric motorbikes running around, carrying people, carrying goods. And not a lot of research is being done on the impact on the grid and their mobility patterns, etc. So we've been working with a company in Kenya called Roam Electric. They manufacture and design these vehicles in Africa for African conditions. And in order for us to collaborate with them, we need these vehicles down here. And it's been incredibly difficult to get the vehicles down here. So that's the one aspect. Just bringing them down here is actually a challenge. So we decided let's drive them down. And then the other aspect is we want to test the performance of these vehicles. And we want to showcase African ingenuity to show that we can make solutions for the continent. And we want to test the performance of these solutions. And we want to do it using clean energy, because as you know, in Africa, we have an energy crisis, especially green energy crisis. Most of our electricity is produced with coal, especially in Southern Africa, South Africa and its neighbors. So we're going to charge these vehicles with solar power every day and then bring them back all the way down to Stellenbosch.
Professor Boysen, it's not just about ingenuity, it's also about practicality, I would imagine, because if this works optimally, it does in time open huge economic opportunity, surely.
Yeah, for sure. And you asked earlier about the challenges. Let me maybe highlight some of those. It's been a real challenge to just get vehicles across borders. We didn't really foresee this. It's taken us a lot of effort to get the requisite documentation just to get the vehicles across the number of borders. We're going from South Africa through Zambia, through Tanzania, all the way to Kenya. And just to get through one of those border posts easily takes us 4 hours and a lot of documentation and a lot of money. But if we can crack this, I think we are at the cusp of using this electric transformation that Africa faces to the benefit of the whole subcontinent, or at least the sub-Saharan African part of the continent. We've got many people who are in a position that can enter the labor market, both in terms of mobility, but also in terms of energy provision. And that's really what we want to protect. We want to protect the jobs that are already in vehicle production, and we want to be sure that we prepare the continent for the electric mobility revolution that's coming. And yeah, I don't want to go into too much detail right now, but let me say that many of the vehicles in sub-Saharan Africa are dumped onto the continent. And these are older vehicles. And the jobs that make them are currently off continent. They're from Asia, and many of the vehicles come from Europe as well. We want to change into a position where those things are made here on the continent, build the skills and keep what we have already.
Let's talk a little bit about the preparedness and maybe impact. And I'm sure that you're hoping for a positive impact in terms of the eventual adoption of electric vehicles and more broadly, Professor, sustainable energy solutions in South Africa. I mean, in many respects, what I'm hearing is that this is barrier breaking.
Yes, it is. It is. What we're trying to do, as I said earlier, is to preserve the jobs and build the skills. And what is interesting about this transformation is it gives us the opportunity to maybe equal or level the playing field. Many of the issues in sub-Saharan Africa when it comes to mobility is related to gender inequality. Also inequality just in terms of affluence. As you will probably agree, many of the people who use public transport, informal public transport, are people who are not maybe of the same level of affluence of those who have private vehicles. And we see this transformation to electric mobility as an opportunity to maybe improve the lives of those who struggle. Just as an example, research has found that women in sub-Saharan Africa travel substantially farther than men do on a daily basis because they tend to be the carers. And what we see is this move towards electric mobility gives you the opportunity to maybe improve their situation, look at ways to support them better, or for example, the safety aspect. So a lot of the public transport in sub-Saharan Africa tends to be unsafe with driving behavior that's driven by incentives. It's not conducive to safety. And with the introduction of electric mobility, you can include a lot of smarts into the vehicle that will improve driving behavior, which will lead to safer passenger experiences. Or the last example that I'll maybe highlight is the tailpipe emissions. In sub-Saharan African cities, we have a high level of urbanization, high levels of pollution. And I'm not talking about greenhouse gas emissions. I'm talking about particulate matter. And those levels of particulate matter that we see in African cities leads to stunting. It leads to a lack of intellectual and physical development of children. It leads to poor health. Many people die annually because of it. So this electric transformation gives us the opportunity to also address those problems. So this is to a large extent a very nice boon. If you allow, is it okay if I give one more example?
Please do.
Another good example is we have found that with the transition to electric mobility, very few of the current mobility patterns for minibus taxis, for example, will even be viable with electric vehicles. If you only do depot charging, what we call in South Africa taxi ranks, the bus termini, if you only charge at those, the viability of mobility will be very low. If you allow charging at home as well, then the viability of current mobility patterns are substantially higher. But as you will know, investment in infrastructure in the poorer townships, which is where the minibus taxis and motorbikes tend to be, the infrastructure just isn't in place. So this gives us an opportunity to also invest into infrastructure in poorer communities and maybe underserviced communities. So with this transformation to electric mobility comes legion opportunities to improve the lives of the vulnerable people who tend to be overlooked when it comes to decision-making and policy-making.
All as a result of a 6,000-kilometer journey. Professor Tinus Boysen, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time. And just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, I asked you about the ouster of the DA mayor in Tshwane, Celia Brink. And I gave you three options. Expected, here we go again, or was it a good move? And not well, with no surprise at all, 84% of our respondents say, here we go again. Today, ESG principles. We spoke about this a little earlier in the program, and my question to you today is, more attention needed? Is it simply a tick box in your company, or better regulation is important? If you have a view on that, please share them with the MoneyWeb at Midday Community, either on X or LinkedIn. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon. We are then up as a podcast after the live edition. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. your trusted source for business and investment insights.